From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And the ball is in the Justice Department's court today after a federal judge ordered the release of more parts of the Mueller report related to Michael Flynn. That's President Trump's former national security advisor, who told special counsel Robert Mueller that people connected to the Trump administration and Congress tried to influence his cooperation with the investigation. The government has until May 31st to produce the materials described in the court documents. For more, we're joined by NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Jeremy.
So Michael Flynn is the former national security advisor. He was part of the Trump campaign. He pleaded guilty to lying to investigators. Take your time here, Phil, because this is complicated, and tell us more about what exactly the judge wants the public to see.
Well, the context for this is the ongoing endgame, if you will, to Flynn's legal case. He has pleaded guilty to this federal crime and admitted his wrongdoing, as it were, in court in a hearing last year before this judge, Judge Emmett Sullivan in Washington, D.C. But the judge wasn't ready to actually go ahead and sentence Flynn at that time. And so there's been motions and other things taking place in court since then to resolve what will happen with Flynn. Will he go to prison for some period of time? Will he get probation or have to pay a fine, et cetera. And in furtherance of that effort in court, the government and Flynn and the judge have been talking about what should happen. And one of the things the judge said in court documents yesterday was he wants evidence the government has produced about things that has described about Flynn's actions. And that's going to be interesting if, in fact, we get this material at the end of the month. And I'll just read to you from some of the material from the judge's court order. One of the things is an unredacted version of the portions of the Mueller report that relate to Mr. Flynn. A transcript of the voicemail recording referenced in some of the court documents that you mentioned a moment ago, in which White House or congressional supporters of Donald Trump ostensibly talked to Flynn about his cooperation with investigators, and also audio recordings of Mr. Flynn's conversation with Russian officials. Now, this is the origin of Flynn's case. He was negotiating before Trump's inauguration with Russia's ambassador about how the United States and Russia should deal with sanctions imposed by then outgoing President Barack Obama's administration. He lied to investigators about that and has admitted doing so. And so if, in fact, we get this material by the end of the month, we could hear this voicemail from some person talking to Flynn about why he shouldn't cooperate, and potentially Flynn's own conversation with the former ambassador, Ambassador Kislyak, about that critical period of time before Trump became president.
Phil, the court filings also revealed a new detail that Flynn told investigators that he overheard or discussed with senior Trump campaign officials the idea of reaching out to WikiLeaks. What can you tell us about that?
That's right. And this is part of the ongoing question about what took place and whether it might have broken the law between Donald Trump's campaign in 2016 and WikiLeaks, which was being used by Russia's intelligence service, the GRU, to release things it was stealing from political targets in the United States via cyber attacks. And what these court documents say is Flynn told investigators that he recalled conversations with senior campaign officials after the release of the Podesta emails. Those are the emails from Hillary Clinton's campaign chairman, John Podesta, during which the prospect of reaching out to WikiLeaks was discussed. Now, according to other court documents and an indictment in the Russia investigation, there were communications between Trump's campaign and WikiLeaks indirectly through the political consultant Roger Stone and people who were working with him. Now, there's been no allegation about a criminal conspiracy that reaches all the way to Russia, but Roger Stone is going to go on trial later this year for allegedly lying to Congress and obstructing its investigation into this part of the story. So we could learn more then. But this evidence from Flynn confirms that there was a widespread desire within the Trump campaign in 2016 to get to WikiLeaks, to get to its founder, Julian Assange, and see what they could learn about what he was receiving and what he was releasing, which was politically helpful to the Trump campaign.
Phil, are we likely to hear from the man himself, Robert Mueller, on Capitol Hill anytime soon?
That's a great question. The Justice Department hasn't, so far as we're aware, raised any official objection to that taking place. But at the same time, you're seeing the same frustrations as the rest of us from the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Jerry Nadler, in terms of actually scheduling something. They hoped it would be this week. In fact, they hoped it would take place on Wednesday. Clearly, that didn't happen. And so the question is, Is Mueller himself less enthusiastic? Is the Justice Department just not playing ball? Or is this just a schedule problem? And will they eventually get to a point where they can agree on a date for him to come up?
It's NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing. Phil, thanks.
Thank you.
And there were a lot of other stories dominating the news this week, and we're going to talk about how social media has been responding to some of them with Femi Okeh. She's host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Femi, good to speak with you again.
Nice to speak to you, Peter. Hello, Jeremy.
Hello, Femi.
All right, abortion, obviously a very big story this week. Alabama passed the most restrictive ban in the country. It was a plan to directly challenge Roe v. Wade in the Supreme Court. And not surprisingly, a lot of protests in response, Femi. Actress Busy Phillips shared this on her late night show, Busy Tonight.
I had an abortion when I was 15 years old. And I'm telling you this because I'm genuinely really scared for women and girls all over this country. And I think that we all need to be talking more and sharing our stories more.
So that was a big reveal, Femi. Then she went on to start a conversation with a new hashtag.
The new hashtag is hashtag you know me. And Busy Phillips posted, one in four women have had an abortion. Many people think they don't know someone who has. So the idea of hashtag you know me is for people who you may well know, people who are out there who have never mentioned that they've had an abortion before, just to actually put it out there that they have and the circumstances in which they've had their abortion. I'm not going to read names. I usually tell you the hashtags, but these people have shared intimate details. So I'm just going to give you the sense of what they're sharing. You know me, I drove my friend across the border to have one. And in some very detailed medical explanations as to why some women felt they couldn't have a viable pregnancy. And then one woman said, I was 15. It was the first time I'd actually had intercourse. I got pregnant. I didn't want it to ruin my life, and so on and so on. So this is a contentious issue. It's controversial. It's emotional. All of those elements are then amplified, of course, on social media.
And how, Femi, is the right in this country responding on social media to the news about abortion laws this week?
I don't want to generalize, Jeremy, but it's such a fierce debate, such a personal debate. One hashtag I've seen, which is it's literally fighting back against the very emotional stories that women are sharing. Hashtag abortion is murder. And then some people are talking about the right to life, pro-life choices. This is a debate that is very well run in the United States. If you look at abortion is murder, you'll see a very different perspective from hashtag you know me.
Well, Hollywood actors are getting behind this as well. They're trying to start hashtags boycott Alabama, boycott Georgia.
Because there's a lot of filming that goes on in Georgia.
Yeah, what
especially.
Kind of traction are they getting?
People are just working out, well, how do I register the fact that I cannot say that I don't like this? So how do we register this with these two states who've changed the law in terms of abortion access? And they are doing it with let's hit them in their pockets. Both of those states actually do quite a lot of business with the film industry, with Hollywood, and that's the way that they feel that they can register the fact that they are very unhappy with what is currently happening.
Femi, I want to talk to you about a couple of other stories that are in the news.
Sure.
This week on social media. Uber just announced a list of new features, including quiet mode, which will allow customers to basically tell their drivers not to talk to them.
Please don't talk to me.
I mean, I feel bad for the poor Uber driver. Maybe they might want to talk to you, but I understand the situation
as well.
I'll
admit, I like this.
Sometimes, it's nice to just have a quiet ride. How are people reacting to this one?
So I'm going to say very swiftly, if you book an Uber Black or an Uber Black SUV, so these are premium rides, so you've paid a lot of money for that journey, you can decide on your app whether you want a quiet ride, whether you want some help with your luggage, or whether you want to change the temperature. And this has been quite popular. But here's another perspective, which Manny brings up, which is these are private contractors. They're independent contractors. You cannot tell them what they can and cannot do at work. You need to pay them way more money for that. But for those of us who are using cheaper Uber drivers, sometimes it's just nice to be quiet,
well,
right?
What do you think the drivers think about this? I mean, they might be okay with it, too. I mean, can you imagine having to talk to every person who gets in the car?
Absolutely. And you never quite know what is it that you need to do to get those 5 stars to keep your rating up high. Do you need to be chatty? Do you need to be quiet? Do you need to talk to them? So I think it takes out the guesswork, which is actually quite helpful. You don't have to guess what does your customer want.
I find it amazing. Sometimes you get into an Uber and it says at the bottom, you know, the driver has 5,000 five-star rides or something like that. Wow. Femi.
That's a lot of pressure.
In the last minute we have to talk about Grumpy Cat. The internet sensation that launched countless memes has died, just 7 years old. How is social media remembering Grumpy Cat?
Appropriately with very sad memes and with cat memes. So Grumpy's real name was Tara Sauce, and she belongs to a family of Tabitha, Brian and Crystal. First became hugely famous back in 2012 when she was posted on Reddit. Instant meme, and people have loved her ever since. The family posted that Grumpy Cat has helped millions smile around the world. You can find that tribute at Real Grumpy Cat. She will be deeply missed, but her meme, her face, that little droopy face, that looked a little sad face, was due to feline dwarfism, and she will be remembered.
It wasn't her fault.
It wasn't her fault.
We needed Grumpy Cat in this era. We needed Grumpy Cat, so we will miss her.
She woke up like that. So Grumpy Cat,
Femi
Okeh, 7 years old.
Host of The Stream at Al Jazeera. Thanks.
You'll be missed.
This weekend, Game of Thrones comes to an end after 8 seasons. It's been on the air since 2011. There will be a lot of people watching, but probably not as many as there were 21 years ago this week when another television icon came to an end. That would be Seinfeld. The finale brought in 76 million viewers. Comedian Carol Leifer was a writer on the show's 5th, 6th, and 7th seasons. I spoke with her last year, and she told me she couldn't believe it had been 20 years since the finale.
It's pretty wild, pretty head spinning.
Well, you wrote for the show during seasons 5, 6, and 7. And I want to just hear a little bit from some of these episodes that you wrote for. Some of them very famous scenes, by the way. Here's a scene from The Rye.
Okay.
When Jerry needs a marble rye at the bakery and finds out that an old woman has the last one.
Yes.
All right. Look, I'll tell you what. I'll give you $50. Now, be reasonable. You cannot turn down $50 for a $6 rye?
No. Watch me.
Stop it. What's that rye, lady?
Help! Someone help!
Shut up, you old pig!
He stole my marble rye. Where did that idea come from? Do you remember?
I do remember. You know, Jeremy, when you write on a show like Seinfeld, one of the hazards of being a writer on a show like that, or really any show, but more so in the heyday of a hit popular network TV show like Seinfeld, was I was always accosted by people who said, oh, you know, I have a great idea for Seinfeld. And it was like, oh boy, here we go. And it's like, you know, Betty keeps her egg salad in the refrigerator at the office. And like, oh my, here we go. But a girlfriend of mine from high school, she said, you know, the funniest thing happened to me. My husband and I had a couple over for dinner, and they brought a bread, and I forgot to put it out, and I realized at the end of the evening that they had taken the bread home with them. And as my friend was telling me this story, I said to her, oh my God, that, I cannot wait to pitch that. That is an amazing Seinfeld story. And sure enough, I went back to the office. And, you know, when you pitch to Larry and Jerry, it was a tough room. You had to go in and you had to grab them quick, because if you didn't, it was curtains. And when I pitched it, they both loved the idea and sparked to it. And that became the marble rye. But when you played that clip, it brought back such a memory to me, because when Jerry wrestles the marble rye away from the old lady and says, shut up, you old bag.
Right.
We looked at each other and we said, he is so beloved a character now, Jerry Seinfeld, that he can take a marble rye away from an elderly woman and say, shut up, you old bag. And the audience smiles and, oh, Jerry, oh, you silly card, you. You know, we knew that that was a special moment in Seinfeld history of belovedness.
Well, and is that how the writer's room worked at Seinfeld, that people were just pitching ideas of things that had happened to them or things that had happened to friends that they knew?
It was a lot like that. When you went into pitch, if it wasn't a tight little idea, you could see them drift off. So when I pitched, like, George brings a deaf woman with him to a party to lip read his ex-girlfriend's lips from across the room to find out why she broke up with him, Larry would leap out of his chair and go, that's a show. We're doing that. That's a show. Uh-huh. And he would get really, really excited about it. And if it was something that had happened to you in real life, I always felt that gave you a leg up because they didn't have the option of going, oh, I couldn't see that. Like, another one of my episodes was The Beard.
Mm-hmm.
And that was culled from real life because at the time, and, you know, here's the 20 years ago-ness of it, I had a gay male friend who worked in banking, and banking, of course, being a very conservative field, he had still closeted, but he asked me to go with him as his date to something with his bank president and his wife. So that sparked the idea of The Beard. But there were so many, you know, like The Soup Nazi, which was a great episode written by a friend of mine, a very funny writer, Spike Ferriston. You know, The Soup Nazi was based on the soup place that was around the corner from The Late Show with David Letterman, where he worked as a writer. So that's always been a good lesson to me also as a comedy writer, is to always be in your life, but always be outside of it, mm-hmm. looking in, because those turn out to be some of the best ideas for a comedy show.
All right, here's another scene. This is from The Understudy, and this is an episode where Jerry's girlfriend is an understudy for Bette Midler, who
yes.
George ends up injuring during an improv softball game in the park. Here's a scene with Kramer, who is obsessed with Bette Midler, visiting her in the hospital.
Right.
Hi. Here. I made this for you.
What is it?
It's Macaroni Midler.
Macaroni Midler?
Yeah. See how you're singing?
Yeah.
Now, what I wanted to ask you about here is, in almost every episode, maybe every episode of Seinfeld, there's a guest character that comes in. How important was the guest character to the show's success?
Well, the guest stars were always important. And as it turns out, there were so many guest stars that went on to have huge
right.
careers. You know, Bryan Cranston was in the Anti-Dentite
right.
episode. But it's hard to believe that in 1995, which is when we shot The Understudy, it was a little difficult to get a guest star to commit to being on Seinfeld. And we really went after a lot of big actresses who passed on it. But what was amazing about Bette Midler when we reached out to her is that the writer that I wrote that episode with, Marjorie Gross, who's sadly since passed on, she was an old friend of Bette Midler. And when we reached out to Bette Midler, having been friends with Marge and going so far back with her, she was like, oh, absolutely, I'll do it. Hmm. And I'm happy to do it. So it was that connection that made us land the amazing Bette Midler and turn in a performance that, you know, is bravura.
All right, well, let's talk about the last episode. You were no longer a writer on the show during the final season, but what did you think when you heard that the show was ending?
Well, you know, I guess like most things, bittersweet. I think with a hit show, it's always very tricky to know when to turn out the lights. And I think Jerry had a very good sense of when it was time. And I think, you know, look, it's 20 years later, and I don't think I'll ever work on a show as legendary as Seinfeld. I mean, they come along once in a lifetime, and what I always call it is lightning in a bottle, and that's very rare. And especially with Jerry and Larry creating it, having the writers they did, but also the cast. Each cast member could have done their own show separately. They're each that talented, and to have them all together and create this ensemble was amazing. So obviously it was sad when the show ended, but I think 20 years later, as I think we all knew then, it was the right time to go.
What did you think of the finale? Because some people didn't like it.
You know, I was a fan of it. I know that it was very divisive or whatever it was, but I liked the tack they took, and I enjoyed it. You know, to me, the real legacy of the show is that it's still so loved. It's, you know, I have high school students. You know, my son is 12 and is starting to watch it and enjoys it. It just, you know, funny is funny. You know, when I was growing up, I used to watch I Love Lucy. And
right.
that was a show that was an old-timey show back then, but it's funny. And I'm just so proud to have been part of a show that's really withstood the test of time. And people still love it and still get turned on to it and still enjoy it.
I watched I Love Lucy, too, but on Nick at Night. But I was a high school student when the last episode of Seinfeld ran, and we put on, me and a friend of mine, put on a Seinfeld day at our school. We had a soup Nazi.
Really?
We had the cable company come in and put in cable for one day so that we could watch on the big screen at school.
Wow.
So, oh, yeah, it was a lot of fun.
That's really admirable. But, you know, it's also a time gone by when they used to call shows water cooler shows because they were watched by millions of people.
Right.
There weren't a million shows to watch. And I remember after I wrote The Rye, I went to our local deli and I walked in and there was a big sign in front like, "We have the famous marble rye from Seinfeld." You know? It's like 2 weeks ago it wasn't that famous,
yeah.
But now, hey.
So what are you doing now, Carol Leifer?
Well, I was honored to work with Carol Burnett on her last two projects, which was the 50th anniversary of the Carol Burnett Show, the special that aired on CBS. And it was just Carol's head writer for her show called A Little Help that is streaming right now on Netflix. And also doing stand-up, just recently opened for Jerry Seinfeld at the Beacon Theater in New York, which was... Yeah, it's really been terrific.
Well, it's a great pleasure to have you on the show today. Carol Leifer, one of the writers on Seinfeld and doing a lot right now, it sounds like. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having... Oh, and also I have a book out called How to Succeed in Business Without Really Crying.
You got that plug in. There you go.
That's right. I talk about Seinfeld in that book. So pick it up, folks.
I spoke with Carol Leifer last year for the 20th anniversary of the last episode of Seinfeld. Again, 76 million viewers for that one. You can tell us about your favorite episode of Seinfeld at hereandnow.org.
This message comes from Here and Now's sponsor, Ember Wave. Ember Wave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat that is designed to help you find thermal wellness in any situation. Ember Wave can put you in control of your comfort in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, cold restaurants, after a workout, at home, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018. Learn more at emberwave.com. Ember Wave, balance through temperature.
Amazon is giving Uber Eats a run for its money. The e-commerce giant is investing $500 million in Deliveroo, the London-based food delivery startup, which is also a direct competitor of Uber Eats. Mike Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News. And Mike, why does Amazon want to get in the food delivery business?
You know, Peter, I don't think anyone from Amazon has actually come out and explained exactly why this particular business, but it makes a lot of sense if you think about Amazon's core business, which is, you know, basically people order consumer goods on the internet or their app and they get them delivered to their home. So this fits pretty well into that, and especially if you consider Amazon's ambitions to sort of take over the delivery process via drones in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So I hate to use a word like synergy, but
it
makes sense in this case, a very complementary business.
Now, this investment is happening in the UK, and if you look at a lot of these other big food delivery services like Deliveroo, Takeaway.com, Delivery Hero, these are based in Europe. It seems like there's a lot of competition over there. How does that compare to what we're seeing in the U.S.?
Yeah, it's a pretty competitive space in the U.S. too when you think about companies like Grubhub and DoorDash and Seamless and, as you mentioned, Uber Eats. And a lot of the ones you mentioned are based in London. And really, that is sort of this, you need that center of gravity of a big city to get these startups up and running. You know, crowded urban area with a lot of young people who live on their phones or on the internet, don't really have the time to cook or the desire, really. And, you know, cities like London, New York, and to some degree, I imagine Boston, people don't even have cars.
Yeah.
So it's really filling a demand there for that service.
Bloomberg has been reporting on something called virtual restaurants. This is interesting. These are places with no wait staff, no in-person customers. You can't walk up to the door and buy something. Is this where all of these investments are headed? I mean, is this the way we're going to eat in the future?
It's pretty fascinating. Yeah, ghost kitchens, they're sometimes called. You know, and when you think about it, again, in a big city, it makes a lot of sense. For one thing, the staff of a kitchen of a busy restaurant can only handle so many takeout orders without causing delays. So instead of turning customers away, you open up shop in another kitchen, a kitchen-only facility, and it's typically in a sort of lower rent area. You don't need that expensive ground floor real estate. It can be on the sixth or seventh floor, and it can be sort of tucked away in a, you know, not a very highly trafficked, foot trafficked type of street. It can be somewhere almost a more industrial area. So it's, you know, it's a matter of them sort of going for that lower rent to satisfy the demand, the surge in demand for delivery that's happening.
Another food-related story this week. American Express announced that it was acquiring Resy. Now, this is a reservation platform, a website or an app that allows you to book online. What does American Express see in this startup?
So what they said in their announcement is they want to make this a perk of being an Amex card member. They're trying to go beyond your basic rewards and point systems that credit cards offer to give customers something extra. And Resy touts itself as being able to get you those hard-to-find, hard-to-get reservations at popular restaurants. So they're, you know, really viewing it as a perk of membership for Amex members.
And probably get a few extra points if you then pay with your American Express.
I'm sure.
All right. Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Peter.
This year, the acceptance rate at some of the hardest colleges to get into was in the single digits. Stanford only accepted 5.1% of applicants, Yale 6.3%. Of course, not everyone wants to go to those schools, but what do graduating students do if they don't have a college lined up yet for the fall? It's already May 17th. Turns out there's a resource for them, a list of colleges across the country that are still accepting students looking to start this fall. And they're also offering financial aid and housing. The list is compiled by the National Association for College Admission Counseling, NACAC, and includes more than 400 colleges. Joining us to talk about it is Lisa Maselli, Director of College Counseling at the University of Illinois Laboratory High School in Urbana, Illinois, my high school. Hi, Lisa.
Hello, Jeremy.
And Todd Burrell is with us as well. He's Director of Undergraduate Admissions at Southern Illinois University at Edwardsville. That's one of the schools on this list. Hi, Todd.
Hello there.
So some of the schools here, Antioch College in Ohio, Bennington College in Vermont, two small private liberal arts schools there, Arizona State University, a public university. But there are 400 colleges on this list. Lisa, is that surprising?
No, it's not surprising. And I think why this list is so important, Jeremy, is it just screams that the elite acceptance rates that we hear about for college admissions are just not representative of what really happens in higher ed.
What do you mean by that?
Well, oftentimes you hear about, it's impossible to get into college nowadays. Schools are admitting less than 10%. And the reality is most colleges are admitting 65 to 70% of their freshman applicants. And so we have to help families understand that it's not impossible to get into college, and some amazing schools with enrollment management are still looking at applicants even into May and June.
Well, Todd, why does Southern Illinois University Edwardsville find itself on this list?
SIUE, as we're referred to, it is an institution that is a regional public institution, and we'll attract students from all over, but majority of our students come from Illinois, and we're close to St. Louis, Missouri, so we'll attract some from Missouri. But the reason is, I think the type of population of students we serve, we're not categorized as a highly selective institution. And we still have students who are still working out their finances, trying to to determine if that would work. And asking for that time to make that decision, although they may be ready to make it financially, they might still be working with their families to determine if everything would work out for them. And I think that serves a great purpose. And I think that's a lot of the schools on that list is there is still room for the students. We hope they decide as soon as they can, but given an opportunity to make sure everything works out in Aaron, because the last thing we want to do is see them coming in, rush in with the decision, and then not be able to work out the finances where maybe they work for 1 year, but then not for the years 2, 3, and 4 after that. And I always use the phrase that it is a lot easier and a lot more affordable for a school to retain a student than it is to recruit, because mm-hmm. so many dollars go into the recruitment of a student.
Do you think that you're going to be able to fill all the slots that you still have open?
That is our hope and our goal, yes. I do think that that'll be the case, and I think many schools on the list will work with those students. And again, we'll push them to make a decision when they're ready, even though, again, it's past that May 1 timeline. Most students probably do know where they're going. It's just making sure it works out before they submit an enrollment deposit that may be, for some institutions, non-refundable. We don't want them to lose that money, so we want them to know for sure.
Lisa, do you still have students after May 1 in a typical year that haven't figured out where they're going yet?
Yeah. I rely on the NACAC list a lot. I know it's not an exhaustive list. There are some institutions that are a little more quiet about not reaching their freshman goal and may not be a part of that list that you're looking at, Jeremy. But for our students, I would say there's probably 4 reasons why I will often be working with a student still adding schools to mm-hmm. their list now. They may have overreached. They may have built a college list where, sadly, if they were looking at some of the most highly selective schools, they were either denied or even waitlisted at schools, so therefore they don't have a real option in their back pocket. Sometimes their priorities change. They built their college list thinking it would be really fun and adventurous to go far from home, and then life happens. Something changes in their family, and they realize, I really need to be closer to home than I thought. And they'll often come in and say, hey, are there any schools with openings in Illinois? Because I really thought I wanted to go out east or west, and my priorities have changed. And then sometimes it's a lot of honest self-reflection, Jeremy. They will come in and say, you know what? I have to be honest with you. I kind of let my ego drive my process of building a college list. I'm not really even sure why I'm connected to any of these schools, and I'd like to look at a few more. And then sometimes, as Todd mentioned, it's money. They may have gotten into schools and they just can't afford them. And now they're starting to look at openings for schools that are still reading in the summertime, hoping that maybe the financial aid might be a little more, you know, beneficial to them and make the choice a lot easier for them to pick a 4-year school and not just how do I afford to get their freshman year. Mm-hmm.
And is the financial aid better right now, Todd?
I think it depends on each institution. I think a lot of schools, when they plan to offer their scholarships and their need-based dollars, such as grants, they offer them to the applicants who meet their deadlines. If the school doesn't quite yield the number of applicants that they expected to, they mm-hmm. might have some additional dollars. So for a student, it might still be that opportunity that they might be able to receive an academic or even a need-based scholarship or grant. But I think right now it's just saying that there's still room here if this would be the place and for you, and it would fit what you need as far as an institution and fit with your, you know, your financial situation.
And is the application process the same if you're applying at this point?
Yes, and I would say that's true for most institutions on the list, is they would still need to apply. Schools can make various deadlines. Even though it's post-May 1, they may have a deadline that they set to say you need to be applied and let them know if you're planning to attend. Because we do have to plan, institutions, universities have to plan for the students coming in, meaning the coursework, the classes, and they want to know that sooner than later, because a lot of them have orientation programs in the summer, and that really helps those students out to get in the proper coursework. And again, we need to know that in advance. So the sooner, the better for the student. And if they're looking at a school that may be on the list, or a school that may not be on the list but still is open for enrollment, to contact that institution and work with their admissions office to determine what those deadlines are.
And Todd, let me just ask you, because some people may hear what we're talking about and say, well, are they lowering the standards to fill the class by accepting students at this point? What do you say to that?
I would say that most institutions, in my opinion, are not. I've been doing this for about 25, 26 plus years here. I don't think there are going to be schools that are going to lower their standards. Some schools may have what are called summer bridge programs or summer success, where they may work with a student saying, although we think you're not quite ready for the curriculum, but if you come in during the summer, take coursework, oh, we're going to put you in some proper placement courses, they can work with them there. But I don't see them changing their admission criteria. It's just really informing the students and the families that there is still room at the various institutions.
Lisa, finally, you know, for those people who are still college shopping right now, what would your advice be to them?
Yeah, I would say the reality is there are so many schools that still have openings now. I mean, heck, like you said, from the NACAC list alone, there's 491 listed. I think they just need to realize that college is an option for them in any stage of their development. I know some students who at other high schools have opted to graduate early. They finished in December and they just assumed that I have to wait an entire year to kind of apply for the next cycle. And now they found that link and they're excited to know that they can still start college in August. So I think for us to just empower families and students to realize there are so many wonderful options, and people like Todd are waiting to talk with families that even think right now it's too late. It's not. And college is an option for kids to start this August.
That is Lisa Maselli, who is Director of College Counseling at the University of Illinois Laboratory High School in Urbana, Illinois. And we've also been speaking with Todd Burrell, Director of Undergraduate Admissions at Southern Illinois University at Edwardsville. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Thank you, Jeremy.
China is scrapping an order for more than 3,000 metric tons of pork from the United States. It's the biggest cancellation in more than a year, according to the USDA, and it comes after the latest escalation of tariffs on both sides of an ongoing trade war, all of which has many farmers on edge. Davey Stevens is president of the American Soybean Association. He's in Clinton, Kentucky, where he grows soybeans, corn, and raises poultry, all three of those products caught up in this dispute. Davey, welcome to Here and Now.
Well, glad to be here.
And how are you feeling at the end of what has probably been a pretty long week for you?
Yes, it's been a very long and yet interesting week to go along with what the discussion is. On Capitol Hill, but also as a farmer and putting a crop in and dealing with Mother Nature and all the parameters that go into that situation.
Well, just a few days ago, there was optimism that the United States and China would reach a deal. But then, as we know, China changed the terms of the agreement. The president responded with higher tariffs. China retaliated. Do you stand behind the president on this issue?
Well, we've over the years, we've worked with every administration that has been in the office, whether it be Democrat or Republican. And he has a path forward, just as the previous presidents have. And we're just seeing how this looks on the horizon and how we move forward in making this where it's a win-win situation for all.
Okay, well, right now you're not winning much because China is not buying anywhere near as many soybeans as it used to. How are you dealing with that? Have you found other countries to sell them to, other places to put them?
That's a very good point you bring up, because we have been working with other countries to developing markets that we have not been as aggressive in.
But there is no market bigger than China. Are you concerned that there will be a surplus of soybeans on the market and that'll drive prices down?
Well, it's very possible. When you look at the stock carryover from what was last year and where that will reach if we do not start moving some soybeans by the end of 2019. And that's one thing you'll see that will completely affect the market just because of supply and demand. And that's one of the things we're trying to do on the American Soybean Association is to get into these other countries that just see the value of our product.
Earlier this week, the president tweeted that our great patriot farmers will be one of the biggest beneficiaries of what is happening now. Davey, are you better off today than you were last summer when this trade war started?
Well, when you look at last year and what it's done to the market, and it's been around $2 drop in the market, that's one thing that has really affected a lot of farmers.
The price of soybean, you mean?
The price of soybean, yes, sir. So as a farmer and personally on my farm, I booked the current year, but I'm also hedging some crop into 2020 and then a very, very, very small amount into 2021 to make sure I've got a market that I can stand financially on what the farm needs and then increase that as I get closer to that year.
We have seen reports of farmer bankruptcies, even farmer suicide through all this. You're on the ground there. You've got members in your association. You're a farmer yourself. What has the financial and emotional toll been on people?
Well, there's a strain emotionally with farmers. And a lot of it right now is the market, of course. That's first and foremost. And then in Western Kentucky and really geographically throughout the United States in other areas of just the amount of rain we're getting. I live on one of the four counties that joins the Mississippi. And that's one thing that is affecting me planting my crop and these four river counties, as well as other river counties up and down the Mississippi or whether it be the Ohio.
So it's not just the tariffs. It sounds like it's all of the factors that go into operating a farm. Look, the president is promising more bailout money to help farmers struggling because of these tariffs, and the administration set aside $12 billion last year for the same reason. Have you gotten any of that money, and is that the right solution?
Well, you hear a lot of news that that's what's going to happen. It's going to be a different amount this year, and this is how it will look. But there's nothing being set in stone that I'm aware of that's where we're at this point.
You don't sound too confident that that money's going to be there.
Well, you always, anytime you deal with the government, you know, that there's different parameters that go into the whole situation, that whether it be my industry or another industry on how that looks and where does the money come from.
Is the president losing the support of American farmers?
The president, I'm not going to say he's losing the support, because when you look at us nationwide, you have some that are aggravated, but you have some that truly still support the president. And it's like that with any situation. It was like that with President Obama, President Bush, President Clinton, and then their predecessors. So it doesn't matter which administration, there can be, you know, both sides of a story.
That's Davy Stevens, president of the American Soybean Association. He farms soybeans and corn in Clinton, Kentucky. Davy, thanks for speaking with me. Have a great day.
Thank you. Have a good day.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.